Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 231 lecture. So this is human anatomy. We're going to get into peripheral nervous system and maybe move into autonomic nervous system. So we're still covering nervous system. We're just right after spring break. Hopefully everybody had a good spring break. Anybody do anything really amazing? Like I asked in my lab this morning, anybody just get out of jail this morning or anything like that? No? Not so exciting? Okay, yeah, mine was kind of laid back. So hopefully you guys studied a lot. So today is April 6th. So let's take a look at the schedule before I douse the lights. And the 6th is right here. Yeah, right after spring break, autonomic nervous system, that's 15. We'll probably get into that today. And then we have two more lectures before the test. Then we have a little break in there. We're going to start the heart chapter, although heart is not going to be on the test. All right, so that gives us a little extra breathing room. So today's the 6th, then the 13th, 1 week, and then a week from that is the 20th. So your next lecture exam is 2 weeks from today exactly. All right, and here are the chapters, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, but not 19. 19 will be on the next test, right? So heart will be on the next. So that lecture exam is going to be on a Monday, and you also notice highlighted in yellow is the third practicum. So those of you that have Monday labs will have the lecture exam on Monday the 20th and the practicum, the third practicum on Monday the 20th. So those will be two exams on the same day. Let me know how that is. Some people find that useful because it's basically the same information, so you can like kill two birds with one stone. All right, well, don't feel bad if you're the Monday group necessarily, because on May 20th, which is a Wednesday, that's when we're going to have our fourth lecture exam on May 20th, and then the Wednesday lab will have their fourth practicum on the same day as the lecture, right? So both the Monday and Wednesday labs will be treated pretty much the same. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have a question on the schedule? Practicums are graded. They're in Blackboard. You look at them. Look them over this week in lab. Got a quiz this week in lab. Muscles, anterior posterior muscles. Next week we're going to start dissections in lab. And so for dissections in lab, you'll need to protect yourself in three different ways. Need to protect your eyes, need to protect your hands, and you got to protect your feet as well. So you have to have glasses, safety glasses, gloves for your hands, and shoes for your feet in case you drop something really sharp like a scalpel or scissors. We don't want those just digging deep into your foot and cutting a blood vessel, right? So try to remember that for next time. And the best thing to do is probably just buy a box of gloves and split the cost with your lab partner. That's the best way to do it, because if you buy them one or two at a time at the bookstore, I think they charge you $1 or $2 for a pair of gloves. And for $6, you can buy a whole box someplace else. All right, so that's probably the best way of doing that. Okay, anybody have any questions before I turn the lights off? But he's situated pretty well. Okay, nice. I'll turn that off. I'll turn that one back on. Turn that one off. And these off right here. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. All right, did I pass it out to somebody already? Good, it is going around. Don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. And also, last week during spring break, there was not an online assignment to do. But don't forget, since school has started up again, you do have a deadline of this Thursday, right, 11 p.m. to do the next online assignment. And there were a couple of people that forgot to do the one before spring break. I don't know how that happened. Sorry if I didn't mention that in lecture. So don't forget, every Thursday by 11 p.m., go into Blackboard, check, and see if there's anything that you have to submit, because we can't go back and open those quizzes up. All right, so peripheral nervous system. How are you going to think of peripheral nervous system? What's a good way to think of peripheral nervous system? Yeah, it's by exclusion, right? It's everything in the nervous system excluding the brain and spinal cord. That's the best way to think of it. And don't forget about that flow diagram that we showed you at the very beginning, the introductory chapter of the nervous system, that breaks all the different divisions of the nervous system down. So try to remember, try to picture in your mind where that peripheral nervous system is, and some components of that peripheral nervous system, which is what we're going to talk about right now. All right, peripheral. Everything besides the brain and spinal cord. So let's see what we got right here. Here's something that's pretty similar to what I gave you in terms of a flow diagram. All right, so the two major nervous systems in the body are central, which you know, brain and spinal cord. Everything else is peripheral. And the peripheral nervous system then can be broken down into two main categories. And these categories are motor or efferent division. These nerves carry information from the central nervous system out into the periphery to effector organs. And what does an effector organ always produce? And that should just be rolling right off your tongue, a response. That's right. And so this motor division of the nervous system will produce responses by activating various kinds of effector organs, right? So we call that the efferent division. All right. Furthermore, you should probably know what some effector organs are, right? If we look at motor and go down, we can see motor can be broken down into two areas, somatic versus autonomic. And somatic means voluntary control. Autonomic means involuntary control. So in the back of your mind, you should know the effector organs for the somatic nervous system. Who knows what an effector organ for the somatic nervous system is, and what kind of response will it produce? Skeletal muscle. What's the response? It's going to be, contraction, voluntary contraction of skeletal muscle. And of course, you know it's skeletal muscle because it's connected to your skeleton, right? So that's why we call it skeletal muscle. What are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? You have smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Those are the three, right? And all those produce responses like contraction, right, or secretion from that particular gland. And then let's just finish off this table right here, this flow diagram, because I like it a lot. All right, the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into two divisions. And you see it's a sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's not on this diagram is the relationship. How would you describe the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic? Okay, we haven't talked about it yet, so this is a stretch, but it's so important. I think it's important that we mention it right now. The relationship is similar to the relationship between the biceps brachii and triceps brachii, which is they're antagonistic to each other, right? And it doesn't mean that they're working always against each other, canceling each other out, but they are working together to provide balance and control, just like your gas pedal and brake pedal in your car. All right, so let's go back up. Peripheral nervous system broken down into sensory and motor, or afferent and efferent. We haven't talked about sensory or afferent division yet. This is what brings information into the central nervous system. This is the beginning of a response loop. And so we have two divisions. We're probably not going to make too big a deal of this. Somatic versus visceral. Somatic means mostly on the surface of your body. Is a good way to think about that. All right, like pain, temperature, that kind of stuff. And visceral sensory just means things that are deep in sensors that reside deep inside your body, body cavities. All right. And then there are some, these are what we call general because you have receptors all over your body for temperature, right? And then there's a couple that are special because you have receptors only in a couple locations. Hearing and vision, you can only see with your eyes, right? If I shine a flashlight on your belly button, you can't see that light because it's a special sense. Only a certain location on your body can sense that particular stimulus. And the same thing for taste and smell. You can't taste anything with your fingertips, right? Ankles, kneecap, only on your tongue. So we call that a special sense. So this is a really good flow diagram to just have in the back of your mind all the time. Okay, so let's look at the text slide for a little bit. So the functional organizations, is that showing? Yeah, nicely on the projectors. Right, sensory, periphery to central nervous system, motor from central nervous system back out to the periphery, like muscles and glands, right? And we already dissected those away into some voluntary and involuntary components. So that's the functional organization. As far as structural organization is concerned, In terms of sensory, we have peripheral sensory receptors. We looked at some of these already in terms of the integumentary system, right? There were free nerve endings for pain and temperature in the skin. There were receptors for pressure and vibration, like Pacinian corpuscles, right? All in the skin. So those are our nice peripheral sensory receptors. And there's peripheral motor endings. This would be for the efferent pathway to skeletal muscle. So how do signals get in or out, leave the central nervous system or enter the central nervous system? It is through nerves, right? And these nerves are either going to exit or enter the brain, enter or exit the spinal cord. So we're going to break all these nerves down either into cranial nerves or to spinal nerves, right? Cranial nerves enter or leave the brain, and spinal nerves enter or leave the spinal cord. That's exactly right. Okay, so here's something that's really good for you just to memorize. There are 12 pairs of cranial nerves, and we're going to know the names and locations of those 12. And there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves. It's probably not so important for me that you know that there's 31 pairs of spinal nerves, but there are, you should at least know that there's a lot more. But for sure, you're going to know a lot about cranial nerves. Okay, so where are some of these things located? Peripheral nervous system. Okay, so what I see right here is a spinal cord. And here I see nerves that are entering or leaving the spinal cord. So what I see right here are these cranial nerves or spinal nerves? Yeah, these are all going to be spinal nerves. And they're going to exit between right in the intervertebral foramen between different vertebrae. And so these origins of these nerves, we would just give them a designation as to where they leave the vertebral column, like C1, C2, C3, C4. Right, so it's going to be between the occipital bone and C1. Here's the C1 nerve, here's C2. Right, and they're just leaving from the cervical region. And then you get the thoracic and lumbar. And then below L2, then you have this cauda equina as well. Okay, so let's go back and talk about this functional organization in terms of peripheral sensory receptors. Where are those things going to be located? Okay. Well, we got free nerve endings. I guess we'll look at the nice dermis right here. Free nerve endings, right, that surround a hair follicle, that can sense motion of that hair follicle when something brushes up against it, free nerve endings for pain and temperature as well in the dermis. And then there's some modified nerve endings, like a Pacinian corpuscle, right, and a Merkel's disc up over here. This is for vibration and pressure. So light vibration and pressure are picked up by these Merkel's discs, a little bit stronger pressure and vibration by the Pacinian corpuscles because they're located deeper inside the integument. So we can classify some of these receptors by their location, right? And if they receive stimuli from the outside of the body, we call these exteroreceptors. And so these are going to be located where? Near on the surface of the body, where that stimulus is easy to perceive, right? So touch, pressure, pain, temperature. Right, and most special senses like vision, hearing, and even balance are due to exteroreceptors monitoring things that are outside of the body. And balance, right? I guess what these receptors are measuring in a sense is gravity. Which way is the earth pulling you? Right. So that really is an external stimulus. You don't have a whole lot of gravity inside your body. Interoceptors are located in body cavities, right, or visceral cavities, and they're sensitive maybe to chemicals or to stretching and again to temperature, right? So they will produce things like visceral pain. Visceral pain is a lot different compared to somatic pain. Somatic pain is very sharp and acute, and you can localize it on your body very easily, right? If you sat on a tack, somebody left a tack on the chair as you sat down, you would feel this very sharp pain, and you would know exactly that somebody didn't poke you in the ear, that you actually sat on something sharp. You could localize that pain very quickly and easily. Right? Visceral pain, on the other hand, could be just as intense, but it's not a sharp pain. It's a dull pain. But it can be very persistent and annoying, and it's very hard to localize where that pain is coming from. Okay? And a lot of times it's very confusing. For instance, if somebody's having a heart attack, the heart will produce pain, but you won't feel it in your heart. You'll feel it in your shoulder, okay, or maybe jaw, or left arm. We call that referred pain. So visceral pain is a little bit different. It could be just as intense, but just not sharp. It's a dull pain. Some other interoceptors for hunger, the sense of fullness when you eat, nausea, these will be interoceptors. And another classification are proprioceptors. So that's a fancy word. Proprioceptors are located in muscles and tendons all over your body, and I should say skeletal muscle in particular, not so much cardiac and smooth muscle. And so where do you have tendons and skeletal muscle? All over your body or just in one location? Where do you have skeletal muscle? One location, like right on your eye or ear or tongue, or all over your body? Yeah, you have muscle all over your body, and you have tendons all over your body. And there are receptors in each of these tendons and ligaments and even in joints. So what I'm trying to have you understand is, let's classify proprioception in terms of whether it is a general sense or a special sense. Remember, general was a sense where you have receptors all over the body, like temperature, for instance. If somebody put an ice cube on your big toe, you could feel it, or your earlobe, or the tip of your nose, you could tell it was an ice cube. Right? That would be a general sense. A special sense is due to just one location. You have a receptor in one, maybe two locations in your body. Who could give me an example of a sense that is special because you have receptors only in one or two locations? Yeah, vision, for instance, your eyes. All right, so now let's think about proprioceptors. You have them in every muscle, every tendon, joints, right? And even ligaments have these sensors. So proprioception is a really kind of a fancy word, but is it a general sense or a special sense? General, because they're located all over your body, right? So it is still a general sense, even though that term seems really special, right? It's just kind of different. All right, another way that we can classify receptors is by the type of stimulus, right? And that's always how a response loop starts. It always starts with a stimulus, and you have to have a receptor in order to sense that particular stimulus. You have mechanoreceptors that can monitor physical changes, stretching or vibration in some tissue in your body. Mechanoreceptors for touch, pressure, vibration. Thermal receptors will be able to sense what? Yeah, heat, for instance, or cold, right? So temperature, thermoreceptors, chemoreceptors. What will chemoreceptors monitor? Yeah, chemical changes. Like, give me an example of a chemical that your body could monitor with a chemoreceptor. What might be some good ones? What might be some good chemicals that your body should be aware of? Yes, like oxygen, right? Oxygen receptors. Carbon dioxide receptors, which will help regulate respiration or breathing. Okay, what kind of receptor would be really good for somebody with diabetes mellitus to have? Okay, diabetes mellitus usually is a result of some abnormality in insulin secretion or control. And what does that insulin control inside your body? Blood sugar. That's right. So the key term there is sugar, right? So if you're a normal individual with normal control over insulin, what is your body monitoring to adjust insulin levels normally in a person? Blood sugar, right? So there are glucose receptors. Glucose is a sugar molecule. So that would be an example of a chemoreceptor, for instance, in the pancreas. Photoreceptors, that's easy, your eyes. And nociceptors, these receptors respond to any kind of damaging stimulus to your body. Could be maybe a burn due to acid or temperature or lacerations, anything that's going to produce some kind of injury to your body. Or chemicals, any kind of chemicals, like maybe ammonia, for instance. All right, so we can classify, let's see, what have we done so far? By location, right? Intro, extro, by the type of stimulus, right? Like thermo or chemo. And then also by their structure. Encapsulated, Meissner's corpuscle, right? And I see one right here. There's a nice Meissner's corpuscle that's in your integument. Pacinian corpuscle, a little bit deeper, right? Ruffini's end organ. These are probably examples of either Ruffini's or Merkel's discs up over here. Since they're very superficial, this is for light touch and light vibration. So those are encapsulated. Then there are some non-encapsulated. We talked about those before. Free nerve endings for temperature and pain. Receptors around hair follicles, right? So you can tell whether or not something is brushing up against your skin. And for instance, if these are eyelashes, right? If your eyelashes are stimulated, what's going to be a very important response? Yeah, blinking to protect your eyes, right? So these receptors right here, depending on where they are, they're very, very important. And then here are those proprioceptors, right? And again, this is a general sensation. These are not deep inside body cavities. They're more on the surface of your body. So muscle spindles, they measure stretch of a muscle. And maybe some of you have had a patellar tendon reflex performed on you where you're sitting and your knee is bent and somebody took a hammer and pounded you on the knee. And even with your eyes closed, what happened? It would produce a jerk. That's right. So you would extend at the knee. That would be due to these muscle spindles right here, because your brain was telling your quadriceps to relax, but then all of a sudden, right, your legs started to extend, and so your body was going to try to resist that stretching, and that would cause contraction of the quadriceps. Right, so those are due to muscle spindles. Golgi tendon organs are not located in muscle, but tendons, and they measure tension, a little bit different than stretch. So stretch is what, like an elastic property. Tension is just the amount of force that's produced on a tendon. So if a muscle is pulling way too hard and it's going to damage the muscle or the tendon, then that Golgi tendon organ will be able to cause that muscle to relax to prevent damage from occurring. And then you have similar kinds of organs located in all joints. And that's a sense of proprioception, so that even with your eyes closed, all right, you can tell exactly what body position you're in. So if you closed your eyes and I walk over to you and I grab your arm and I put your hand above your head, you could tell me, where's your hand? Well, you would know, it's my right hand and it's above my head. Or if I put it underneath your chin, you could say, it's not on top of my head anymore, it's underneath my chin, even with your eyes closed. All right, and that's because all joint capsules have proprioceptors in them. Okay, peripheral motor endings. I think we've looked at these already, like the neuromuscular junction. Let's see, I think I have them someplace. Here. Let's look here. Okay, so here we have a axon of a neuron. Right? Can you recognize this as an axon? What are the three parts of a neuron? The three structural parts of a neuron: dendrites, cell body, and axon, right? And can you see this to be an axon right here, because the signals are leaving, for instance, you can't see the cell body, but they're leaving the cell body, going down to the axon terminus, right? So here is, since the signals are leaving the central nervous system, going to this effector organ right here, what kind of neuron is this? Let's classify this neuron right here. What kind of neuron is that? You got two choices. It's either taking information away or bringing information to the central nervous system. So look at these arrows right here. Which way is this information going? And remember, a neuron can only carry information one direction, not two ways. So what direction is this? away from the cell body down an axon. Okay, and so this is leaving the central nervous system, going to this skeletal muscle. So this is an efferent or motor neuron, just by looking at these arrows. Okay, and so here is that junction between the motor neuron or somatic motor neuron, because this is going to a skeletal muscle, and the skeletal muscle itself. What do we call this junction between the neuron? Just a general classification of this junction between the motor neuron and the skeletal muscle. I like it when I heard synapse, right? And furthermore, you should be able to classify this as a chemical synapse, because the information goes through the synaptic cleft as a chemical signal, right? The signal moves along the axon as an electrical signal, and then that electrical signal is converted into a chemical signal. The chemical moves across the synaptic cleft, and it binds to a receptor in the skeletal muscle, right? And that causes another electrical signal on the skeletal muscle. So information goes electrical, chemical, electrical through a chemical synapse. All right, so in that axon terminus, I see these vesicles. And these vesicles contain that chemical that moves across the synaptic cleft to carry the signal to the effector organ. And what's the general name of that chemical in all of these vesicles right here? Yeah, neurotransmitter, because it's coming from a neuron and it's going to transmit information to this effector organ. Furthermore, you should know some examples of neurotransmitters. What's your favorite example of a particular neurotransmitter? Here is a really good example, acetylcholine, abbreviated ACH, right? That's an important neurotransmitter. At every neuromuscular junction, that's a special kind of synapse between a motor, somatic motor neuron, and a skeletal muscle fiber, right, uses acetylcholine as the neurotransmitter 100% of the time. There's no other kind of neurotransmitter that works at the neuromuscular junction. There are many other important neurotransmitters, and we'll probably look at a couple in this chapter. Okay, so here we have acetylcholine in these, what we call synaptic vesicles. When this electrical impulse comes down to this terminal button, then the vesicle moves over to the presynaptic membrane, releases neurotransmitter, then it diffuses over to the postsynaptic membrane, binding to the acetylcholine receptor, causing electrical signal. But if that acetylcholine were to remain in the synaptic cleft, then the skeletal muscle would remain contracted. It would never be able to relax again. And of course that wouldn't be good, because if this was a diaphragm, means that you would be able to inhale one time and then that would be it, because the diaphragm would never be able to relax again. Right? So that acetylcholine has to be removed from the synaptic cleft, and there's an enzyme that breaks acetylcholine down so that, right, that muscle can relax. The enzyme that breaks acetylcholine down is called acetylcholinesterase. And anytime that you hear a word with an ASC on the end of it, you should know that, should recognize that to be an enzyme. And that enzyme is going to break down acetylcholine. That enzyme is located right within where we find all of these receptors. It's on the postsynaptic membrane. So acetylcholinesterase is on the postsynaptic membrane. Okay, it's not inside the muscle cell, not inside the axon, not floating around in the synaptic cleft, not on the presynaptic membrane, but on the postsynaptic membrane. So whoever asked that question, that was a good question. Sorry, it was a little long-winded, but I wanted you to kind of get a feel for where it is and why it's so important, right? So if this neuromuscular junction didn't have acetylcholinesterase, right, then I would think, I would like to relate that to a light switch that we have in this room. What can we do with a light switch in this room? What can we do? We can turn the lights on and we can turn them off. And then what can we do? Turn them on again and turn them off. Right? If this was a neuromuscular junction without acetylcholinesterase, what would happen? Turn the lights on and then you could never turn them off. right? Again, they would just stay on. So that's the importance of being able to get rid of that neurotransmitter once it is released from that neuron. Okay, that is, okay, that neuromuscular junction and how important acetylcholine is. And any kind of neuron or receptor that works on acetylcholine, we call these cholinergic, a cholinergic neuron or cholinergic receptor. All right, we also talked about motor units when we looked at muscle a couple weeks ago. Right, a motor unit is just one somatic motor neuron and all of the individual muscle fibers that it innervates. So for instance, postural muscles in your back, you don't need a lot of dexterity. So the motor units are large. One motor unit and maybe thousands of muscle fibers are connected to that one motor neuron. But in your face and in your hands, what we call innervation ratio is a lot smaller. You might have maybe five or six muscle cells or muscle fibers attached to one motor neuron. So you have a lot finer control over all of your digits, right, and facial muscles. Okay, innervation of skeletal muscles and glands. I don't think we're going to talk about that very much. I don't think we have a picture in your book. Let me see. Maybe in the autonomic nervous system, I'll mention that. Okay, but for the autonomic nervous system, okay, instead of having just synaptic vesicles at the axon terminus, you will find that if it's an autonomic nerve, that these swellings will be located along the whole length of an axon. So there'll be a swelling, and then a narrowing, and then another swelling, and in each of those swellings will contain synaptic vesicles which can release neurotransmitter. So not just at the tip, but along the whole axon. Right? And we call those varicosities. And just for future reference, there's a different kind of neurotransmitter that's used in the autonomic nervous system, and maybe you've heard of norepinephrine. Right? There are a couple. Epinephrine is one, norepinephrine is another. There's another name for epinephrine. Does anybody know a more common name for epinephrine? It is adrenaline. Adrenaline and epinephrine are exactly the same thing. Okay. So what has to happen to norepinephrine or epinephrine once it is secreted from a motor neuron? Just like what has to happen to acetylcholine so that the effects don't last forever? They have to be broken down. That's right. So for acetylcholine, we have acetylcholinesterase, right? But for norepinephrine, there's a different kind of enzyme. It's called monoamine oxidase, or MAO. And maybe some of you might have heard of MAO before, because there are certain class of drugs that are called monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or MAO inhibitors. And these are really good for, they act as good antidepressants, because a lot of times somebody that is experiencing depression has a depleted norepinephrine signal. And so when monoamine oxidase is reduced, then the effects of norepinephrine are enhanced, and that helps people recover from depression pretty rapidly. Okay, neurons that use norepinephrine are not cholinergic. We call them adrenergic. Right, so neurons that use norepinephrine are adrenergic. Neurons that use acetylcholine are called cholinergic neurons. Okay. All right, so cranial nerves. Where do cranial nerves come from?
Brain.
The brain, that's right. And how many pairs of those do we have? Yep, there's 12 of them. All right, and so they have a nice number. Okay, so here I see a nice brain, right, frontal, temporal lobe, cerebellum, pons, medulla, is all that sort of making sense? Hopefully you can see these structures here. Okay, and all of these things that are in yellow or gold, what do you see? Green, huh? No. Hopefully gold, some yellow, something like that. Okay, yellow. All right, so these are the cranial nerves. And if we were to count down from anterior to posterior, we would see 12 of them, right? And the one that's most anterior, fortunately, we're going to give that the number 1. And then the one just posterior to that is going to be given the number 2. Right? And then the one posterior to that is going to be given the number 3. So do you see how these things are numbered? Pretty easily. Right? So I could ask you, okay, what number of cranial nerve is this right here? And as long as you know how to count to 12, it's no problem. Right? And so that's exactly how this thing is laid out, right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, okay, 5, and all the way on down the line. But they also have names, and they also have specific functions. All right, so how are we going to remember some of the names? Well, okay, this first one right here, you can see here is the olfactory bulb. This is for the sense of smell, right? And this is right above the cribriform plate. And I think that was in the ethmoid bone. Remember where that cribriform plate was on either side of the crista galli? So here are a bunch of nerves that leave the olfactory bulb for this sense of smell. The scientific name for the sense of smell is olfaction, right? So olfaction is for cranial nerve number 1. So if you're walking and you think you're walking into a building and you didn't see that there was a window right there, you just thought it was an open space, what part of your face would hit the window first? Your nose. And then what would hit? Then your eyes would hit, right? All right, so cranial nerve number 2, posterior to cranial nerve number 1, this is for vision. So here is the optic nerve. And I think you remember optic nerve. When did we look at optic nerve somewhere? Oh, because we looked at the optic canal when we were looking at the cranium, right? The cranial bones. All right. So this structure looks a little bit different. I see a letter of the alphabet when I look at this optical nerve right here. Does anybody think of what kind of letter of the alphabet this reminds you of? An X. That's right. Okay. And there are nerves that cross over from the right to the left and from the left to the right, because what you see in your right visual field goes to the left side of your brain, and what you see on the left visual field goes to the right side of the brain, and so those signals have to cross over, and this is exactly where they cross over, the center of this X, that's called the optic chiasma. All right, so here you have the optic nerve. Now, where do we have nerves? Where do we have nerves? And what I want to know, they're going to be in a different location than a tract. Where do we have nerves and where do we have tracts? It was just a definition from before spring break. Okay, where do we let's start with a tract. Where do we find a tract? Inside the brain. Inside, as a matter of fact, anywhere in the central nervous system. And of course, brain is central nervous system. So a tract is myelinated axons in the central nervous system, and a nerve are myelinated axons not in the brain or spinal cord, but in the peripheral nerve. All right, so this little piece of cranial nerve number 2, this is actually the nerve, this is the optic nerve outside of the brain going to, where is it going to? What's going to be right here where the cursor is kind of floating around? Yeah, there's going to be an eyeball right here, right? And that's going to be connected to the brain via the optic nerve. It's going to cross over at the optic chiasma. That's the entrance to the central nervous system. And so what do we call these things right here, now inside the central nervous system? It's the optic tract, right? So let's look at that once again. Here's the optic nerve, peripheral nervous system, optic chiasma. That's the entrance to the central nervous system where these nerves, some nerves cross over. And now you have nerves in the central nervous system. We call that a tract. So you got optic nerve, optic chiasma, optic tract. And just like for cranial nerve number 1, it is a sensory nerve, right? So sensory, is that afferent or efferent? Afferent. So cranial nerve number 1 is afferent. Cranial nerve number 2 is afferent. And it's only going to be afferent. There's no motor function to these nerves at all. All right, oculomotor. Here's number 3. All right, oculomotor. Take a guess. Is this going to be afferent or efferent? Oculomotor. When you hear motor, you're going to think efferent right away. Efferent. So here are electrical impulses leaving the brain to control some muscles that control where your eye is looking or where it's going to be allowing light to enter. All right, and We haven't looked at those yet. There's some muscles around the eye, right, that control where your eye is looking. All right, number four is trochlear. Five, trigeminal. All right, and then let's go down to six, abducens. All right, this works on some muscles around your eye, and the name tells you what this nerve is doing. It's a motor nerve. It's not a sensory nerve for vision, but it's a motor nerve, and it's going to help position your eye. Remember, you can look right, you can look left, right? You can look up and down. What do you think the function of this abducens is going to be? Yeah, it's going to abduct. And what does abduct mean? Move your eyeballs to the side. But of course, don't do that with both eyes at the same time, right? So one is going to abduct while the other adducts. So the abducens is important for abducting. Okay, facial nerves, vestibular, cochlear. Well, let's take a look at some of these cranial nerves. All right, here's a nice list. If you look in the book, all right, it might give you five or six functions for each cranial nerve. Well, that's a little bit too much. I just want you to know one important function. And so cranial nerve number one, we call that the olfactory, that is smell. All right, number two, optic, that's for vision. Ocular motor, I want you to know that to be pupil constriction, right? That's going to adjust the amount of light that enters or leaves the eye. Trochlear controls where your eyeballs are moving to, right? Trigeminal is sensory to the face. Again, the abducens is an eye muscle. The facial is for taste, right? And we're going to look at some of these others. Another important one I want to point out to you is vagus. And the one thing I want you to know for vagus is that it decreases heart rate. Now, what kind of organ is your heart? What is it made up of? Skeletal muscle? Glands? Cardiac muscle, yeah. And what kind of muscle is that? Is that voluntary or involuntary? It's involuntary, but not smooth muscle. It's still cardiac muscle, but it's involuntary. All right, so it's controlled by part of the autonomic nervous system, which we're going to get into pretty soon. And so here we see the vagus decreases heart rate. So you would expect that there should be some other nerves that do what to the heart? Increase, right? So you see that antagonism there? All right, so the vagus nerve is a very important nerve of the parasympathetic nervous system. And in this particular case, it slows the heart down, the heart rate down. There are other nerves that speed the heart up, right? But they're not within the vagus nerve. So vagus is, I want you just to know that it's important for decreasing heart rate. And after the next chapter, you'll see that it's part of the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay. So what's important? Well, when you get into any kind of clinical program, like nursing program or any kind of program, you're definitely going to have to know all of these numbers, the names of those nerves, right, and some functions. So here are some functions that I like. So how do you remember this long list of names of cranial nerves? Well, there's something that is really handy to use, and it's called a mnemonic. See mnemonic right here? And a mnemonic is a little saying, like a sentence or a little poem or something. And you take the first letter, okay, of each of these cranial nerves. So you got what? You got an O for olfactory, O for optic, O for oculomotor. And then make a sentence that makes sense to you out of the first letters of each of these terms. And here is a mnemonic that I like for cranial nerves. And it says, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. So how many words are in this mnemonic? There are 12, because there's 12 cranial nerves. Okay? And so the O and on stands for olfactory, the O in old stands for optic, and the O in Olympus's stands for oculomotor. And who can tell me something about Olympus right here? Olympus is. What is this sentence referring to? If you lived in Europe, it would make a lot of sense. It's a mountain. It's a really big, important mountain in Europe, right? Olympic, Mount Olympus. And that's where this towering top comes from. It's a really tall mountain, right? And here is a fin. What's a fin? Is that something used for swimming? No, it's a person, right? It's a person from Finland, right? And German, that's somebody from Germany viewed that's looking at a hop. What's that? A dance? It's a hop, could be, but it's not in this sense. It's not. It is a grain that's used to make beer, okay? All right, so, and I guess somebody was thinking, well, people from Finland and Germany really like to drink beer, and so they grow a lot of hops, right? And so here are a couple of people looking at all these nice grains, thinking of Oktoberfest later on. Okay, so that is one way to remember, okay, all of these cranial nerves. Sometimes it's really easy because here you have, what, an H, and there's only one H in this whole sentence, and so there's only one cranial nerve, and here it is, hypoglossal. Right, hypoglossal, that's motor to the tongue. Right, V, there's only one V. Well, is that, what is this view going to? Yeah, Vegas. And what number is Vegas? Well, you could count from the beginning, but let's count from the end. Hop is number 12, A is number 11, and viewed is number 10. Yeah, you jumped ahead just a little bit, that's okay. All right, so Vegas is cranial nerve number? Number 10. Yeah, that's going to be really important. That vagus nerve you're going to love, right, for the rest of your life, right? So that's number 10, vagus. Okay. So let's see. So we got on for olfactory, old for optic, olympus for oculomotor, towering for trochlear, top for trigeminal, A for abducens, F for facial, A for vestibulocochlear, G for glossopharyngeal, V for vagus, A for accessory, and H for hypoglossal. Did that make perfect sense to you? Anybody have any questions on that? No questions? Oh, wait a second. Wait, did I miss something here? Let's see. Vestibulocochlear, number 8. Okay, so here you got, what, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8. Oh, here's an and. How does that relate to vestibulocochlear? Ah, okay, I remember now. Okay, this and right here stands for auditory nerve. And what's the function of auditory nerve? Hearing, okay? But that's been simplified. Instead of saying hearing, it's called vestibulocochlear, because it comes from the vestibule and the cochlea, and part of that is for hearing. Okay, so this little mnemonic right here might be a little bit old compared to this modern nomenclature. Vestibulocochlear, when we get into senses in just a couple of days, that will make really good sense, right? And you'll really see that it really has nicely been simplified from auditory to vestibulocochlear. All right, and you see this O? Right here, what does that mean? Taking two things, joining them together, right? And the two things we're joining together are the cochlea and the vestibule. They're parts of the inner ear. And you don't really know much about them right at the moment, but it will be really obvious once we get to that chapter. Okay, that's for hearing and balance as well. Okay, hearing, is that a general sense or a special sense? Yeah, it's special because you can only hear with your ears, right? And in particular, the cochlea, that part of the ear. Okay. Another thing that somebody might ask you is not only the number of the cranial nerve and the name and the function, but what kind of function it is. So remember, the function of a nerve could be sensory or it could be motor, right? And if there's a nerve that it has both of those kinds of neurons, then it would have both afferent and efferent neurons packaged together in a nerve. We would call that a mixed nerve. It's both for sensory and motor on your body. So a lot of times we would want to know which of these cranial nerves are purely sensory, which are purely motor, or which are mixed. Can actually carry information in two directions because they have neurons going in both ways. So here is another saying, right? And so we define S to be a sensory function and M to be motor. And if there's a nerve that has both efferent and afferent nerves in it, we say that to be both, or B, right? So we're going to make a sentence using S, M's, and B's. And so here it is. It's sort of like another mnemonic, right? And so here it is. So how many words should we have in this mnemonic? 12, because there's 12 cranial nerves. And this one is pretty easy to remember, right? And here it is. Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. Okay? So what does M stand for? Motor. All right, and here's most. That's number 12. That's the 12th word in this list. What's the cranial nerve? What's cranial nerve number 12? Yeah, on Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German views the hop. It's got to be an H. There's only one with an H, so I know that to be hypoglossal. So the hypoglossal, the function of the hypoglossal nerve is M, which is motor. All right, and that is to your tongue. You don't have to know. Oh, yeah, right here, you should probably know that. Okay, so you can write on your lecture exams, right? So you can write these mnemonics down or make up your own mnemonic that maybe makes more sense. Your book has some other ones that I can't remember, so I'm not going to tell you to try to remember them, but it might make more sense to you. Go ahead, read the chapter and pick up a mnemonic that will help you remember some of these things. There is a website right here, okay, called medicalmnemonics.com. And I've had trouble today using this site, but here is a site that has thousands of mnemonics on it, just various sentences, and these mnemonics relate to anatomy and chemistry, physiology, botany, all kinds of different disciplines, probably music, various kinds of things like that. Okay, and they're just various sentences that will help you remember a whole list of terms. And you can put various filters in medicalmnemonics.com, and just filter out all the X-rated mnemonics, okay, please? And just use, like, PG-rated mnemonics. That would be best in class, okay, especially if you write them on a test. All right. Okay, so if you look at this figure, could you figure out which cranial nerve is which? Yeah, just going from anterior to posterior, you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. All right, there's just a little bit of a jog in this region right here because the very last one is 11, okay? And 12 is a little bit more anterior and above it. That's the only thing that's just a little bit strange on this illustration. And you'll have to know this for the practicum in the last practical exam as well. Oh, maybe this is going to be on the third practicum, okay, where we're going to have a brain, and it will be easy to see these cranial nerves. Okay, so we looked at cranial nerves. What other kind of nerves do we want to look at? Yeah, spinal nerves. And remember, there's 31 pairs of these. And remember, some cranial nerves are purely sensory, some are purely motor, some are mixed, but spinal nerves are always going to be mixed. Right, in every single case, right? Not the roots, but the nerves, as they're moving through your body, they're always going to be carrying efferent and afferent signals together. So there are neurons oriented in both of those directions. Okay, let me take a look and see what we have. All right, so here I see some nice spinal nerves, right? Here's the spinal cord. And I think we looked at this already in terms of the central nervous system. Here is a way that information can enter the central nervous system. This is a root, okay? And this is going to be on the posterior side of the spinal cord. So this is what we call the dorsal root. And here's a nice pseudo-unipolar neuron. And remember, those are always going to be sensory neurons. There's the cell body and the dorsal root ganglia. This is how information enters the spinal cord, the dorsal root. That information can leave the spinal cord via the ventral root. And when these two roots come together right here, what's the function in this area right here? Is it efferent or afferent? Is it sensory or motor? Right in this location. I wish I knew, is this brown or red? Red, okay. And then here's blue. So what do you see right here? Do you see red or do you see blue? I see both. Yeah, what do we call it when something in this color scheme is both red and blue? It is mixed. That's right. So here is the spinal nerve, and what can you tell me about the function of a spinal nerve 100% of the time? It is mixed. That's the proper term, right? It is both efferent and afferent, and you can actually see these nerve fibers going right through there. Okay, and you got 31 pairs of these things. All right, so here's the spinal nerve. It bifurcates. It splits into two. Here's the dorsal ramus. This part of the nerve is going to go and innervate everything that is posterior to the spinal cord. Here is the ventral ramus. This is going to bring innervation to everything, all the parts of your body that is anterior to the spinal cord. Right? And where do you have most of your body located? In front of your spinal cord or behind? In front of. So which ramus do you think would be bigger, the dorsal or the ventral? It's not shown on this diagram, but indeed the ventral ramus is going to be a lot bigger, a lot thicker, because it just has more nerve fibers going to more locations compared to this dorsal ramus. All right, and the ramus. What can you tell me about the function of a ramus, whether it is the ventral ramus or the dorsal ramus? Is it afferent or efferent? It is mixed as well, right? So there are nerve fibers oriented in both directions. Okay. What I don't see on this figure, do I see it anywhere? Oh, I see it right here. All right, so here is the ventral root. Here's the dorsal root. These are composed of all of these little entrances or exits from the spinal cord. These are what we call rootlets. So when rootlets join together, that forms a root. And rootlets, just like roots, are either efferent or afferent. They're never mixed. Right. And then the roots join together to make the spinal nerve, which is mixed. And then here you can see that little dinky dorsal ramus and the really big ventral ramus right here, big, thick ventral ramus. And here is something we call the dorsal root ganglion. It's located in the dorsal root, right? Here's the dorsal root. And now somebody should tell me, remind me, what the heck is a ganglion? It's a cluster. I like that, a cluster of these nerve cell bodies, right, of these pseudo-unipolar neurons, and where is it located? Where's that ganglion located? It should always be located in the peripheral nervous system, right? So ganglion is peripheral nervous system. By modern nomenclature, your book is a little behind the times on that, because anatomy books sometimes take 100 or 200 years to change, because everybody thinks anatomy doesn't change very much, and this is true. But a ganglion is in the peripheral nervous system. What's a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system called by modern nomenclature? That's called a nucleus. Remember that? A nucleus is in a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. Group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral is a ganglion. Your book sometimes calls the basal group of nerve cell bodies in the brain the basal ganglia. But if they're in the brain, what should you really call them? Mm-hmm. Yes, the basal nuclei, because they're in the brain. They're not in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, so roots, medial to the spinal nerve. Yep, roots are medial to the spinal nerve. They're either afferent or efferent, never mixed. Rami, lateral branches of the spinal nerve, and they are always mixed in function. All right, so just make sure you know rootlets, the roots, spinal nerve, and the rami. Okay, one last thing. The rami communicantes. Let's go to the next slide. I like it. We're going to get to that one. All right, so I see, what am I circling right here? Spinal cord, part of the central nervous system, right? You can see the gray and white matter. Then what am I circling here? Rootlets, and then here we have roots, and then the roots join together to form the spinal nerve. Then following out over here is the dorsal ramus. Here is the ventral ramus. That's right. And the rami, don't forget, are always mixed. Now here we have some interesting tissue. You see this? Going right up and down along the vertebral column. And these are ganglia. So what are we going to find in these ganglia here? Nerve cell bodies, right? Nerve cell bodies of neurons. Okay, so we call this group right here, the sympathetic chain ganglia. All these ganglia are linked together, and they're part of an important autonomic nervous system. All right, so here we say sympathetic trunk ganglion right here, part of the sympathetic chain ganglia. What part of the autonomic nervous system are these helping maintain in your body? Okay, the two parts of your autonomic nervous system are parasympathetic and sympathetic. Which part do these, the sympathetic trunk belong to? The sympathetic division. That's right. Okay, and that's the next chapter that we're going to get into. But I want you to know the sympathetic chain, there are nerves, okay, that leave the ventral root. All right, well, what's the function of a ventral root? What is it, efferent or afferent? It is efferent or motor. So there are motor nerves, right, from the sympathetic nervous system that enter this spinal nerve right here, okay, and then they go into the sympathetic chain. And so this is what we call a rami communicantes. When a sympathetic nerve fiber enters the sympathetic chain, sometimes it synapses here and then it goes back into the spinal nerve, a second neuron, and then it goes to some body region to bring that sympathetic information to it. So both of these are what we call rami communicantes. And we're going to talk about these in probably a lot more interesting detail when we get into the next chapter. All right? But I think I want you to know that these communicantes right here, these rami, right, are bringing what kind of information in the autonomic nervous system? It's either going to be sympathetic or parasympathetic. And it is 100% sympathetic information. Right? And in the next chapter, you'll get a good sense for what's sympathetic versus parasympathetic. All right, so what have we looked at? We got rootlets. We got roots. Right? And in the dorsal root, we got dorsal root ganglia. The roots come together to make this spinal nerve. Right? Spinal nerve then splits into the two rami, right, the dorsal or ventral ramus. And from this ventral ramus, you have a couple other pathways for sympathetic information, and those are the rami communicantes. So rami is what? Is plural for ramus. Okay. Another good view is just a superior view. So what do we see? Nice vertebral body. We got spinal cord, right? And we got some meninges around the spinal cord, right? Meninges surround every part of the central nervous system. And the dura mater is part of it. Oh, what is this space right here? Anybody remember what this space is that's outside the dura mater? Okay. Arachnoid is a little bit deep to the dura mater. This is outside the meninges. Okay. It's like, you can think of this as like being below the dura mater. On top of the dura mater. So here's dura mater. It's on top of the dura mater. What's on top? What's an anatomical word for on top? Like, what's on top of the dermis? Epidermis, right? So what's on top of the dura right here? The epidural space, right? And so here's some adipose tissue. Anybody familiar with this epidural space? Anybody ever get an injection in this spot right here? And what's the purpose? Sometimes they inject anesthesia into the space right here, and it prevents nerve impulses from going through the spinal cord at this region, and it prevents pain from entering your brain from these nerves right here. Right? So an epidural is used as a form of anesthesia, and that's really nice because is it general anesthesia or is it local? It's local. It only acts in this area. It typically is used for parturition. So you can administer anesthesia to the mother, but what about the baby that's being born? No anesthesia. That's wonderful, right? Because you don't want to depress respiratory system or cardiac system in a newborn. So it's a really handy way of just a local anesthesia. Okay. So here we have that spinal cord. And I see a root. What root do I have the cursor on right now? You know, I'm going to have to zoom in. But I'm going to lose the arrow. All right, so I see nice spinal cord. Here is a root Do you believe that to be a root? And which one is it? Dorsal. What's the function of this one? It's going to be sensory or afferent. All right. And here's the dorsal root ganglia. What root is this right here? Ventral. Okay. So these roots are follow the same architecture as the brain. All right. So here is the ventral. So is this anterior or posterior, this ventral one? Anterior. And the function is motor. What's the motor part of your cerebrum? Is it anterior or posterior, the motor part? Anterior, right? Like the frontal cortex, right? The precentral gyrus is motor, right? And so that helps explain why this ventral root right here is motor. It just follows the same pattern that's in your brain. And what is sensory in your brain for the surface of your body? Somatosensory cortex. Anybody remember where that is? That is the parietal lobe, and in particular, the postcentral gyrus. And so here is, right, sensory, posterior in the spinal cord. So that makes nice sense. So remember, just remember the brain. Motor is in the front, just like your car, right? Okay. And then I can also see the communicantes here and the sympathetic chain ganglia. And what else can I see? Oh, I can see the dorsal ramus and the ventral ramus. It looks a little funny because here it looks like the dorsal ramus is bigger than the ventral. And maybe in some locations it is. For instance, if this is the thorax, you might have a lot of big skeletal muscles in the back and just some small intercostal muscles that are anterior. But usually it's the ventral ramus that is bigger compared to the dorsal. All right, so what is important for you to know? I want you to know some peripheral nerves in particular, right, like the phrenic nerve and the sciatic nerve. Let me put this figure away. Okay. Oh, just the next figure. All right, so here we have a nerve coming from occipital bone and C1. So here is the C1 spinal nerve, here's C2, C3, and then you see this big mess of nerves, interconnection of nerves. And an interconnection of either blood vessels or nerves in the body we call a plexus. All right? But this is not a vascular plexus, this is a nerve plexus. All right, so why do we have this big complicated thing right here? Well, let's look at the phrenic nerve. Here is the phrenic nerve. Where does the phrenic nerve get information from? C5, C4, and C3. All contribute to the phrenic nerve. And I want you to know that the phrenic nerve goes to the diaphragm. Right? It causes the diaphragm to contract. And what's the importance of the diaphragm to you and to me? Breathing. Is breathing good? Absolutely, right? Every minute of the day, that diaphragm's got to be working. So every minute of the day, what can you tell me about this phrenic nerve? It's got to be working as well, right? Because that diaphragm is a skeletal muscle that needs this innervation. And what's the origin of that phrenic nerve? The diaphragm gets information from C3, C4, and C5. The purpose of this plexus is that if there's damage to C4, right, there's damage to C4, what about the diaphragm? Is it totally out of business? No, it still gets information from C3 and C5, right? So the nerve plexus is there because it can sustain a lot of damage, but there still can be important nerve signals getting to a vital organ. Just because there's damage to one nerve, a vital organ still can receive innervation and function properly. All right, so another way of thinking of that, let's just say that you live over here in the spinal cord, in this region up over here, and you want to get to school, which is down here in the phrenic nerve someplace. How can you get to school? Well, you can leave, get off a freeway maybe at C3 and get to school, or C4 and get to school, right? Or C5 and get to school. So if there is like a sig alert between C3 and C4, what are you going to do? Take an alternate route to get to school. Yeah, get off the freeway on C3, right? Take some surface streets to get to school. So it just allows right, alternate routes information to get to those vital organs. And so a plexus can share information, but it can sustain damage without losing function to a particular region. All right, so phrenic nerve, important for breathing, right? That keeps you alive. How are you going to remember? Because that's in your notes right here. How are you going to remember that the phrenic nerve arises from spinal nerves 3, 4, and 5? Okay? Well, you can just memorize. Some people can memorize really well. But there's a little saying, right? And you want to know what the little saying is that's kind of handy to remember? The little saying is, see, 3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive because it allows you to breathe. Okay? And you can lose either C3, right, but keep C4 and C5, you're fine, right? You could leave C5, but as long as you have C3, you're good, right? That's the beauty of that nerve plexus. And what division of the spinal cord does the phrenic nerve arise from? You got cervical, you got thoracic, you got lumbar, you got sacral. It is cervical. Yeah, it's a cervical. Even though that nerve has to go all the way down to the diaphragm, it still comes from your neck, okay? All right, so we're going to finish up the rest of peripheral nervous. I've just got a couple little items left. Another plexus, and that's about it for peripheral nervous system. The sign-in sheet is going around, and I'll see you guys in lab.